A sense of place today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Nigerian-American writer Teju Cole doesn't pull any punches, and his new book is all about the intersection of tough topics, politics, race, and place.
I'm a citizen of two countries who is both at home in the world and not at home in the world, not at home anywhere, really. How does one encounter place and travel and literature and art coming from this placelessness?
Also, we'll connect the dots between the Clinton Foundation, the State Department, and Hillary Clinton's private email server. And a teacher has a tip for speaking the language of one remote Canadian tribe. Try not to spit.
Like, face away and then try it, like...
The story is coming up today on The World. Great to be with you again. And you know that feeling when you go away on vacation and it feels like nothing's changed? Well, guess what? I took off for a few weeks, R&R in Cape Cod, got back, and the war in Syria is still on. Refugees continue to ply the risky waters of the Mediterranean, and racism hasn't suddenly disappeared.
Racism is not somebody calling me the N-word. That happens very rarely. It does happen, but very rarely. Racism is the fact that black folks can't get a mortgage.
That's writer and photographer Teju Cole. We'll hear more from him in a few minutes. But first, another story that's been bubbling along since I've been gone on vacation. Hillary Clinton's emails from when she was at the State Department. Great twist, though, now from the Washington Post. They've had a long look at some emails that became public as a result of a lawsuit. And they seem to show that access to Clinton and her inner circle when she was Secretary of State may have been influenced by donations to the Clinton Foundation. The lead reporter for the Post was Rosalind Helderman. So the Clinton Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the Clintons, founded by Bill Clinton, presided over by both he and Hillary Clinton. What did you find to be the connection, Rosalind, between the foundation and the emails you were digging into?
Yeah, what we found was that there is this worldwide network of friends and supporters of the Clintons. They've been on the world stage for a long time, people who have given them political donations and also people who have persistently given them donations to the Clinton Foundation, who did appear from these emails to have a sort of back-channeled direct line into Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. Often these would come through Doug Band, who had been a longtime aide to Bill Clinton and was very active in the Clinton Foundation. And he would back channel to Huma Abedin, who was Hillary Clinton's deputy chief of staff, and say, this person, he's a good friend of ours. He's trying to get a meeting. He's been having trouble. And sometimes Huma Abedin would respond, you know, I'm working on that, or let me look into it. I'll see what I can do. It's important to note that sometimes these people seem to be seeking more than a meeting. And we have not found evidence that they would typically always get satisfaction. We also have not found evidence that sort of the donations were linked directly to what they wanted. You know, this person gave $10,000, we should give them what they wanted. It's more of a kind of culture of access, or people who are longtime supporters politically to the foundation had an ability to get through to Secretary Clinton that other people might not have had.
We should really point out that Public Radio International, which owns this program, The World, has contributed to the Clinton Foundation in the past. What about The Washington Post?
As far as I know, The Washington Post has not contributed. It is important to remember, though, that the Clinton Foundation, we've done a lot of examination of this. They are indeed a real charity. They do good work around the world, and a lot of people have given money to them before the political season, in the time frame when she was Secretary of State. Giving to the Clinton Foundation was perceived as a sort of bipartisan do-gooder thing to do.
To be fair, it looks like being a donor to the foundation, the Clinton Foundation, was no guarantee that your favor would be granted, right? I mean, Bono experienced this.
Bono did experience this. Bono wrote to someone in the Clinton world and said that he wanted to try to find a way to get a hookup to the International Space Station during his concerts. Did anyone have any ideas? And the response back to that one from both Huma Abedin and Doug Band was, no clue.
Is any of this illegal? And what about unethical?
Illegal would require a whole investigation, and the thing they would have to determine is whether there was a direct connection where a donation, a quid, was given in direct exchange for some kind of government action, and it would have to go beyond a meeting. So they would have to find a direct connection between a donation and an official government act. I don't think we've seen evidence of that in the emails that have come out thus far. Certainly, Republicans would like there to be a deeper investigation. fashion in which you would look beyond just the emails and you would look at other documents and do a full investigation. Donald Trump has just today called for a special prosecutor to look at this. As for unethical, I mean, that's really in the eye of the beholder and the voter to decide what they want. I think there is a broad expectation that what you see in these emails is kind of the way Washington works, the way government works. In this particular political year, you know, I don't know that it's exactly a winning slogan for her to say, you know, nothing we did was worse than business as usual.
Rosalind Helderman of The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Power and the abuse of power, those are two themes among many that author and photographer Teju Cole considers in his new essay collection. It's called Known and Strange Things. I wanted to start by asking Cole about another topic that also shows up in the book, race, and where he feels things stand as America's first black president ends his time in office.
After the past 8 years of America having, well, maybe a slightly self-congratulatory feeling about having a black president, the backlash against that, this sense of like, okay, wait a second, that's too much progress, too fast. But it is disappointing, you know, because you always hope that you can sort of have your progress be genuine and evade the kickback, the talkback, the backlash, which I see as one of the dominant elements of the current discourse.
Let's move off politics and talk about you for a moment. I mean, you were born in the U.S. and raised in Nigeria. I know your work from Open City and Every Day is a Thief. And this new collection, Known and Strange Things, takes us deeper into how you see the world. Tell us more about your own story, how your relationship with Nigeria has evolved and what you find inspiring in your travels these days.
Well, you know, something interesting that happened to me a couple of days ago was sending a note. My siblings and I were sort of talking on text about the Olympics, which I was not even fully absorbed in this time around. But I just sent a note to them and I said, well, we've won. This was shortly after Nigeria won the bronze medal for men's soccer. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, we've won 109 medals so far. And what I meant by it was that the U.S. had won 108 and Nigeria had won one. You know, this is my sense of we, you know,
yeah,
that I'm a Nigerian citizen and I'm an American citizen. I'm not especially patriotic about either place, but I feel very invested and connected in the arguments that are taking place in both of those places. And this is sort of the genesis of the essays in this book, that I am a citizen of two countries who is both at home in the world and not at home in the world, not at home anywhere, really. How does one encounter place and travel and literature and art coming from this placelessness?
And if you're homesick, you toggle over to Google Maps. So what do you do? What do you do when you get there?
I used to have this dream when I first came to this country more than 20 years ago of being in a helicopter over Lagos. Well, that was the form my homesickness took, of wanting to actually see the city from the air. And now I can just go to Google Maps and go over to satellite view and just zoom in closer and closer and closer until I actually see my family's house and with the two cars parked out front. It's a very strange thing, but it kind of becomes this digital way of making contact with what is, after all, very far away.
There are so many thought-provoking essays like Natives on the Boat in this book of yours. You actually wrote it in a boat. It's kind of hard to imagine the boat as a kind of installation art project in London. And the boat was called Roi des Belges, the same name of the boat Joseph Conrad took down the Congo River many years ago that led to his novel Heart of Darkness. But you're writing about a dinner party you went to in New York City for the writer V.S. Naipaul. And you note that both Conrad and Naipaul, though several generations apart, were both fond of using the N-word. And I'm just curious to hear from you how its context changes depending on who's using it, or does it ever?
So first thing to say about the N-word is that it's a murderous word. Contextually, it's a way of saying, your life has no value to me. You know, that's the context in which it emerged when it's being used to refer to a slave. And then in contemporary use, I think if somebody's using it in an offensive way, they're trying to use it as a lance to kind of hurt, to kind of poke. And it does hurt, just like any slur would hurt, because it carries within it all the echoes of its actual physical violence. But it's also true that it's possible for people in different contexts to do things of trying to reclaim a word, to use it in a affectionate or jocular way as a way of attempting to lessen its power or to establish in-group boundaries, you know. You know, racism is not somebody calling me the N-word. That happens very rarely. It does happen, but very rarely. Racism is the fact that black folks can't get a mortgage. You know, that's much more interesting, much more important an issue.
So Portrait of a Lady, one of the essays about Malian photographer Seydou Keita. Mm. Tell us about him and why you're drawn to him.
So Seydou Keita, as well as Malik Sidibe, are two of the leading African photographers. They both happen to be from Mali.
Both portraitists.
Yeah. And, you know, what happens with photography is that it sort of captures this one moment out of the flow of time. And so it just sort of stands there as this register of a mystery that should not have been capturable. And here it is, captured, available for our future interrogation and for meditation. And what I love about Seydou Keita and Malik Sidibe really is that it gives us this wordless and yet very dense and comprehensive account of the lives of people who lived in Mali in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, in such a delicate and richly descriptive way that we come to sort of love these lower middle class, working class Africans in a young African country in what is now a bygone generation. For me, the body of work that these two photographers present is as rich as a novel. It's like reading The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann or Buddenbrooks, which just sort of gives such a rich account of a society to which we do not otherwise have access.
So, final question. I gather you curated a playlist, several playlists at this point, if my Google search was accurate.
Right.
But there was one you drew up for OK Africa, One Night in Lasgidi. And we're not talking kind of Fela Kuti nostalgia here. This is music from a more recent generation of artists, Wizkid and Asha and Nneka.
Absolutely.
What's going on right now in Nigerian music that excites you?
Well, I hope we can exit this with one of the current Nigerian jams, or Niger jams, as we call them.
Lasgidi, call it. We'll play it.
Yeah. Lasgidi is our nickname for the city of Lagos. And it's just a dynamic, energetic place that takes great pride in itself and in its cultural products, but in none of its cultural products so much as its music. The music that comes out of Nigeria, which is an amalgam of a dancehall and hip-hop and traditional Nigerian music and R&B and all of this stuff mixed together to create a kind of euphoric sound, is music that goes out to South Africa, the Congo, Kenya, Tanzania, Ghana. You go to any of these places and all the kids are listening to Nigerian music. We seem to have found the sweet spot. And even when I go out at night in Harlem or in Brooklyn, I'm very often listening to both American music and to Nigerian music.
Stuff that's just coming out of storefronts or wherever you happen to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, people talk about Nigerian literature and all of that, but Nigerian music is currently our biggest and most finished export. So if you take us out with something by Wizkid or Davido, that would be fantastic.
We'll do some Wizkid. I hear Alicia Keys is a fan. She tweeted a picture of her dancing to Wizkid.
She's a fan. Drake is a fan. I mean, so many people are into it because it's just good stuff.
Writer and photographer Teju Cole's new collection of essays is called Known and Strange Things. Teju, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to talk to you again, Marco. Always a pleasure.
Music from Nigeria's Wizkid there, a track called Jai Jai, featuring one of Fela's sons on saxophone, Femi Kuti. You can hear it on Teju Cole's playlist, One Night in Lasgidi. Later on the show, getting out the word about Zika in Miami, in English and Haitian Creole. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. This next story on the show today is about failure. That's all you really need to know. Oh, okay, it also helps to know that failures can often lead to great achievements. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
Serene Grama had a great idea. I mean, a really terrific idea. It was so good that MIT awarded him one of its most prestigious entrepreneurship prizes. His team built an invention using old car parts to heat water in rural parts of the developing world. Think of the possibilities. Medical clinics could sterilize devices, or people could just take a hot shower. revolutionary, right? Grama took the invention to India and got this reaction.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. But here's our problem.
Grama had made a classic mistake, designing a technology looking for a problem to solve. Rural Indians didn't want to talk about hot water. They wanted to talk about milk.
India is the largest producer and consumer of milk in the world, and all that has to be collected in this very time-critical process, which leads to a lot of spoilage, low-quality milk that, you know, it's been sitting around for hours in the sun.
Grama set aside his award-winning solar water heater and focused on milk instead. He moved to India and soon realized the main thing making milk go bad was unreliable power.
The thing to understand is that all these villages do have power. They don't have it 24 hours a day.
But if Grama could tap into the power grid when it was on and store energy, he could keep milk cold. The challenge was building a better battery.
It's a thermal battery. It's like making ice. We make ice. The process of freezing a material stores energy, and when that material melts, it releases the energy.
It worked. Grama's team has sold 300 large industrial milk chillers in India so far. Take a moment and think about what this means. Millions upon millions of gallons of milk are no longer being wasted. That's fewer people getting sick and less money being lost by small rural farmers. The MIT Sloan School of Management was so impressed with Grama that they're bringing him to teach this fall as its first ever entrepreneur in residence to focus solely on the developing world. So, first, MIT gives him an award for inventing a solar heater. Then the university gives him a job because few wanted to buy it.
Many entrepreneurs fail the first, second, even third time, and having someone who can be honest with the students is very important.
Georgina Campbell-Flatter is executive director of the Legatum Center for Development and Entrepreneurship at MIT. Here, they encourage students to get out of the lab and into the developing world to tackle real problems.
How do I think through the import-export challenges of moving my medical device from Boston to Lagos? How do I share profits with an artist who lives in rural India when they don't have a bank account?
I used to work in Rwanda. And I was working with farmers, and we had major struggles securing transport that was reliable for them. And
also recent MIT master's grad Sai Masood Hamzi is now camped out at a shared workspace on campus. He's launching a company to improve trucking service in Rwanda. He describes his company as Uber for commercial trucks in Africa. Hamzi has been getting guidance on a near-daily basis from Serene Grama, the milk guy.
This program is trying to help push us to make sure we're not just coming out or, you know, often looking at things very simplistically or paternalistically. Oh, these people have some problem. Poor them. I know I have the right knowledge. Let me go fix it for them. I don't think that works very well.
Of course, there's also the Steve Jobs philosophy. The Apple co-founder famously said, "A lot of times people don't know what they want until you show it to them." I asked Serene Grama what he thinks of that.
It's a good point, but I think very few of us are like Steve Jobs.
Grama says, sure, inventors can get lucky, but he knows firsthand it's best to understand the market before you design a product. Millions of Indians who now have more fresh milk are no doubt glad Grama has come to see things that way. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boston.
Some mistakes, of course, are bigger than others, like the ones that get you sent to prison. And that's where we're headed next. I want to talk about prison currency. For decades, it was always cigarettes, but now it's something else, ramen. Yep, it turns out that noodles can open doors behind bars. Inmates also view ramen as the perfect food. That's a word from Boz Dreisinger. She's the author of Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World.
Ramen is one of those ubiquitous foods that has basic nutritional content. It's cheap, it's easy, it's available. A lot can be done with it. It's a very malleable food, so it can be it can be at the base of many recipes and turned into a lot of other kinds of food.
And in the ramen trade in correctional facilities, are there specialties like hot and spicy ramen or certain brands being sought after more than others, like the Korean ramen is better than the Japanese ramen, or is it not even that specific?
I don't think it's that specific. It also becomes a question of what happens to be what commodity is available in a particular commissary. I mean, it's choice is not usually on the agenda when it comes to prison and foods.
Right. And what about other prisons around the world? I mean, what is the equivalent of ramen currency in other places that you found?
There are actually striking similarities in prison currencies. For my book, I visited 9 countries and learned a little bit about the commodities there. Cigarettes, of course, is the big one, and that depends on whether a particular country allows for smoking in its prisons or not. But for the most part, we're talking about basic necessities like food. We're talking about space. In the Ugandan prison I was at, which was dramatically overcrowded at almost a 300% overcrowding rate, having a space to sleep was a commodity that was traded, which is, of course, a glaring tragedy.
Yeah, of course. What commodity surprised you and where did you find it?
Space certainly surprised me as a commodity. In South Africa, airtime, smuggled phones are a great commodity in any prison context. But how you make calls, you need airtime. And so South Africa is certainly, airtime is a big commodity.
Are some countries' correctional systems more open than others to trade? Actually, some may let inmates bring stuff in that might count as currency?
Well, I think it's that they're kind of informally open to trade. In other words, they're letting the system sort of run itself. And Latin American prisons, particularly Mexico, Venezuela, are notorious for that, where there is an ecosystem that the guards will essentially just leave alone. And it's even bigger than looking the other way. They're just sort of encouraging you handle this, you deal with this. Gang-run prisons, certainly in South Africa, where I was in Polesmore Prison, that's a notoriously gang-run prison. All of those kinds of prison scenarios are ones in which people are going to trade freely and the prison will look the other way. I've been in other prisons in Australia, for instance, somewhat more experimental prisons where people are given kind of credit cards and it's deeper than a commissary. They're actually given kind of a real currency to work with which is meant to promote independence. So it's actually connected to the philosophy of the prison, which is we want to make this as close to real life as possible. And in real life, you go to the supermarket and you purchase things and you prepare your meals and so on and so forth. So they're very encouraging of a market like that because it approximates real life.
Boz Dreisinger, the author of Incarceration Nations, thanks very much for your time and explaining this to us.
Sure, thank you.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the story of a Canadian tribe that had their language beaten out of them, literally.
You got your mouth washed out with soap. You got spanked with a hard brush or a belt that was pretty wide and pretty thick. And so you can imagine, like, I learned English pretty quick.
That's still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Turkey shares a 500-mile border with Syria. Not that that matters much, because it's increasingly clear that Syria's civil war and the fight against the Islamic State transcend that border. The people of the Turkish city of Gaziantep know this all too well. More than 50 people were killed by a suicide bomber at a wedding there over the weekend. Some Turkish authorities believe ISIS may be behind that attack. My BBC colleague Mark Lowen is in Gaziantep.
This is a city of about 1.5 million people. It's about an hour's drive from the Syrian border. And of course, this is where that attack happened last Saturday, the worst terror attack this year in Turkey, but the latest, sadly, in a wave of bombings, both by IS and the PKK, Kurdish militants, over the past year or so. It is a place that has become inextricably drawn into the Syrian conflict across the border. There are big Syrian refugee populations here. There is a known ISIS presence in the city with cells here that the government is trying to tackle. But it has sadly become a place which no longer takes safety for granted.
What government operations, what Turkish government operations have you been seeing, Mark?
Well, it's happening an hour out of Gaziantep in a place called Karkamish, which is where about 1,500 Syrian rebel fighters are gathered in a Turkish military base. They've been brought into Turkey. They're brought in from Syria by Turkish intelligence. And we interviewed one of them yesterday, a Syrian Arab rebel fighter who's part of the Free Syria Army. And he's one of the 1,500 or so who are now waiting for the green light for this ground offensive into Jarablus. But before that ground offensive takes place, Turkey military is launching air bombardments against ISIS. So the Turkish government says that the aerial bombardment is intended to open up a corridor for the ground offensive to take place, which we expect to happen probably within the coming days.
But isn't Turkey shelling both ISIS and Syrian Kurdish forces, both sides?
It is. And to understand that, you have to really get inside the mindset of the Turkey's internal conflict with the Kurds, or with the PKK Kurdish militants is a better way of expressing it. Mm. Because the PKK has been waging an insurgency here in Turkey since the 1980s. And Turkey classifies the PKK as a militant, as a terrorist organization, as does the US and other Western governments. And Turkey believes that the Syrian Kurdish militia is basically an extension of the PKK here in Turkey. So it does not want the Syrian Kurds to consolidate its territory, consolidate their territory on the other side of the Syrian border. And so Turkey is now shelling both ISIS and the Syrian Kurdish militia to drive them back and to try to stop them from joining up their territory. And what the US and Turkey's allies, it appears, have agreed to is that Turkey would lead or would back the ground offensive into Jarablus as long as it can also target the Syrian Kurds along the way.
You know, for a long time, nearly 2 years, Turkey kind of turned a blind eye to the ISIS threat because ISIS is fighting the Kurds. What brought about what seems to be a pretty sudden change?
I think what has happened really in the past year or so is that because there has been this wave of bombings in Turkey that have been blamed on IS, that has sort of woken Turkey up, I think, rather belatedly to the threat of IS. Also, of course, in the wake of the failed coup here last month, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has reached out to Russia, to Vladimir Putin, who, you know, is very keen to intensify the fight against IS. And I think that Turkey's strategy in Syria is slightly shifting. Having been a very vociferous opponent of President Assad, it is still in that respect, but it now says that the Prime Minister now says that Assad could be part of a transition in Syria and that basically Turkey wants to play a bigger, more active role against IS. That, of course, would be welcomed by the US and Turkey's coalition partners. But it seems, as I say, that a price of that is also military action against the Syrian Kurds at the same time.
My colleague at the BBC, Mark Lowen, reporting from Gaziantep, Turkey, near the Syrian border. Mark, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
We know how the war in Syria has scattered refugees across Europe, but this next story is about an effort to bring them together and save a piece of Syria's musical heritage. Catherine Girardot reports from Berlin.
Raya Cezbe is a hard guy to get a hold of.
I am not good in English, but I think I can continue this interview.
You're doing great. I tried for quite a while, but eventually got lucky. I met one of Cezbe's colleagues, a Syrian cellist, at a music festival. He gave me Cezbe's phone number. And a few international calls later, we arranged to meet in Berlin. Cezbe, who founded several orchestras in Syria, is from Aleppo.
I live in Bremen, Germany now, since 2013.
It was during a tour in Germany with an Arab youth symphony that friends convinced Cezbe it wasn't safe to go home. He stayed and ended up at a refugee center in Bremen.
And then when I arrived to Germany, I noted that a lot of Syrian musicians live in Germany and Europe. And I said, okay, we can start a Syrian orchestra in Europe.
He started trying to find his colleagues from the High Institute of Music, Syria's only conservatory. Back home, it had been a tight community. Pretty much all the classical musicians there knew each other. But finding his friends again in Europe was tough. Everyone was scattered.
So I asked myself how I can contact the musicians, and I don't know their emails or phone.
Like so many Syrians, a lot of Cezbe's colleagues had to flee the country in a hurry, leaving pretty much everything behind.
So then I contacted them by Facebook, and find them, and some of them, they say, yes, I'm in Europe now, I can play with this orchestra, blah, blah, blah.
Last September, Cezbe managed to assemble enough Syrian musicians to perform a concert in Bremen, the first concert of the Syrian Expat Philharmonic Orchestra, SEPO.
Yeah, it was a fantastic moment for all of us. We were 30 Syrian musicians from all over Europe, and we sit in one hall, and we feel that we are in Syria, because we see Syrian faces. For sure, we lost many things in our homeland, friends, family, study, work, home. But in this orchestra, you get a feeling that you are in Syria now.
Tell me, how do you pay for this orchestra?
The most difficult thing in this orchestra, the funding. Because you have to cover the travel cost for all these musicians from many, many cities, and accommodation, rehearsals, music hall for concert. So always we try to find a sponsor to support these concerts.
SEPO as an entity is more of a vision than a reality. Many of the musicians are playing on borrowed instruments. When they meet up to rehearse and perform, they sleep in people's homes, not hotels. But encouraged by support from German cultural and refugee aid organizations, Jezbe's determined to expand his project.
Last year, I invited 53 Syrian musicians from Europe. This year, I invited 80 Syrian musicians in Europe. So the number is bigger and bigger.
SEPO's first concert in Bremen was sold out. The group actually ran out of encores and had to play one piece over again for the enthusiastic crowd. But things are changing in Germany. A couple of high-profile attacks there have people increasingly worried about the refugees in their midst. One German musician I spoke to said the country shouldn't be supporting additional cultural organizations, like a Syrian orchestra. But Jezbe is not easily discouraged. He's focused on trying to save a piece of his country's 7,000-year-old culture.
Now we have a lot of destruction in Syria, so maybe we can save the music and culture by this symphony orchestra.
Since SEPO's first concert, they've also performed in Switzerland, and Jezbe recently got a call from the Berlin Philharmonic.
The organizer from the Berlin Philharmonic told me that I tried to contact you from 6 months.
And he invited them to open the Philharmonic's current season with an open-air concert in Berlin on August 27th. Jezbe says he's thrilled and hopes the opportunity will open more doors for the orchestra.
I hope in the future we can change this project to real work for the Syrians, to change their situation from a refugee to professional musicians.
For the World, Catherine Girardot, Berlin.
In Florida, Zika continues to spread. Today, officials announced a mosquito-borne case of the virus in Pinellas County. That is more than 250 miles from Miami, where the first locally transmitted cases in the U.S. were reported. In Miami, city leaders are trying to get the word out about Zika in English, Spanish, and in Haitian Creole. That's because Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood is in the zone where Zika first broke out. Dr. Smith Joseph is the mayor of North Miami. So we've got 5 cases in Miami and Miami Beach, and 4 of them in Wynwood in Miami, all non-travel cases of Zika, so presumably local transmission. Now I hear a 6th case confirmed hundreds of miles from Miami. Is it known how this cluster happened in this Haitian community in Miami?
Well, thus far, you know, we have no evidence to really pinpoint the actual culprit, you know, for this spread of the disease in this area. But what we do know, a few months ago, there was a study where they did identify the state of Florida and Texas, the airports in New York and New Jersey, being on the top of the list for possible outbreak of the Zika, just because of the nature of our, you know, passengers, you know, people who travel, you know, to countries where Zika is endemic. So it's very important for people to be aware of the areas, you know, that are at high risk, and, you know, people who are, you know, women who are pregnant or any woman in childbearing age, we are urging them to be as prudent as possible. But the effect that we see, Marco, is that people are getting a little bit frantic, and it behooves us, you know, to really step in front of the battle to make sure that this does not become a disaster for this area.
So, Dr. Joseph, as mayor of North Miami, how have you been taking that information and trying to pass it on to people who need it? And in doing that, are there language challenges? I mean, there are a lot of Haitian Americans who speak Creole.
Oh, no, we don't have that problem because we speak Creole, you know, fluently. I was born in Haiti. I came to this country when I was 18. So we've been brainstorming. As a matter of fact, about 2 weeks ago, I sat down with my city manager. We've already laid out a plan for educating and informing people in the area. As a matter of fact, Miami-Dade County has already put out a pamphlet, you know, instructing people what to do, the signs, the red flags, you know, that they should be looking for. And last week, I and two other colleagues, a medical doctor, we taped a local television show in Creole, in the Haitian language, and people have been watching it since. And so we are doing all efforts, or everything that is possible to keep people abreast of everything that's going on about the Zika virus.
Haitian American families in Miami, they are concerned a lot about their families back home in Haiti. They take care of them. School is also about to begin. So I'm just wondering whether Zika is being taken as importantly as it should be right now. I mean, you talked about some panic, so I suspect that people are taking it seriously.
Well, it is being taken seriously, and I'm glad that you keep emphasizing the Haitian community, because a couple of weeks ago, I was talking in the same way that you are now, and I was approached, you know, by a journalist from Miami Herald. The question was raised as to why is it that, you know, all of the pamphlets that we've seen, they are only in English and Spanish and not in Creole. So we've been actually waving our hand and say, hey, you know, the Haitians are here. We speak Creole. We are the second largest immigrant group in Miami-Dade County. So therefore, any efforts that is being taken, you know, to instruct and to inform the people, should that comprehensive plan should take into consideration the Haitian population.
Dr. Smith Joseph is the mayor of North Miami, Florida. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Michael. It was a pleasure.
Before we get to a short break, here's a story about magic spells, demons, even ancient amulets locked in forgotten caves. No, this is not some Harry Potter or Game of Thrones thing. I'm talking about the result of an archaeological dig in modern-day Serbia. Ilija Danković is part of a team from the Archaeological Institute in Belgrade. They were excavating the site of an ancient Roman military town when they came upon a woman's grave. They kept digging, says Danković, and found a selection of magic spells inscribed on gold and silver pages buried with the woman's body.
We are talking about protective magic. Someone, or that woman herself, wanted to be protected against dark forces, against black magic, or maybe against something, disease, you know, that she had.
That wasn't the only set of spells found at the site. The team have also come upon another grave nearby, also protected by spells. So far, Danković and his colleagues have only been able to decipher a few of the names engraved on both sets of scrolls, and they are not ordinary names.
So far, the names of various demons, indeed, that are known from the territory of ancient, what is nowadays Syria, have been recognized.
And maybe, Danković says, that's why there's a bit of fear floating around the dig site.
Some of our workers on the dig have superstitions about the find, you know, but Romans believed in these things very much. The official state of Rome recognized them as something real, as something that is functional and something not to be fiddled around with.
Right, because as the saying goes, when in Rome, don't fiddle around. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let me take you for the balance of the program today to British Columbia, just a few miles north of the U.S. border. This is a story about two generations and the language that almost died between them. Now, this is a language that used to be widely spoken, not just in British Columbia, but also in parts of Montana, Idaho, and Washington State. But U.S. and Canadian policies of assimilation nearly killed off the language. Alina Simone reports from Creston, British Columbia.
Ann Jimmy is 68 years old and one of the last native speakers of Ktunaxa, a language isolate unrelated to any other on Earth. Until she was 5 years old, it was the only language she spoke. Then one day,
my grandfather told me that when I go to school, I was going to learn how to read. I couldn't wait to go to school.
She remembers getting in the car with her parents.
And I didn't really pay much attention, didn't realize that a suitcase was being carried.
They drove for more than 100 miles until they arrived at a huge gray building where they were greeted by a priest and some nuns.
One of the nuns came toward me and started talking to me, and of course I didn't understand what she was saying, but when I looked, my parents were gone.
For the next 8 years, St. Eugene's Residential School in Cranbrook, British Columbia, was her home. There were only a couple other Kutunaha kids there, but
the ones that, you know, would talk to me, they would whisper, because if you were caught speaking your language, you got punished. You got your mouth washed out with soap. You got spanked with a hard brush or a belt that was pretty wide and pretty thick and hurt a lot. So you can imagine, like, I learned English pretty quick.
Kutunaha, among many other languages, was pushed to the brink of extinction by Canada's boarding schools for Indigenous children.
I wouldn't even speak my language. I understood it. I remember my grandfather, the very person that told me and excited me about going to school. I remember telling him, "Speak English, I don't know what you're saying," which I knew what he said. But I was so brainwashed, and I know that he was hurt by that.
Years went by. Anne grew up, had children, and never spoke Kutunaha with them.
I was suffering from all the pain, the strappings I got. My language was beaten out of me.
Not quite. Though no longer fluent, when I asked Anne to recite some Kutunaha for me, she chose a native translation of the Serenity Prayer, which begins, "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change."
Ninku nikin sal saka kunata hamatiktu kutsatsukutchunimu.
The status of Native American languages has changed recently. In 2008, Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper officially apologized to the First Nation people.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history.
The government established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and paid reparations to people like Anne, who suffered years of abuse at the boarding schools. On the micro level, things changed for Anne, too. She had a granddaughter. Jenny Jacobs didn't grow up speaking Kutunaha, but heard it enough to realize she was missing something.
It was kind of sad because I taught myself a little bit of Spanish and all these other languages, and then I was questioned, like, why didn't you learn your own language? It was like, I don't know, because I have people that speak it. And so that's when I started learning the language. I started looking at the words and started teaching myself it.
Today, Jenny is the language and culture teacher at Yakanuki, the Kutunaha Reservation School. And from the look of written Kutunaha, it's not an easy job. The language is peppered with glottal stops, question marks, apostrophes, scent signs, and a mysterious double-barred L. Jenny had to get creative to help students wrap their tongues around these unfamiliar sounds.
Our barred L, that one was kind of fun. It's like, because I grew up with it, so I could automatically say it. They were kind of like spitting at each other. So then I got to remind them, like, don't, like, face away and then try it, like, just try and do that. And then, so they did it. After a while, they got pretty good with it.
Who knew language learning could be a contact sport? Just a few years ago, it looked like Jenny might not have any students left to teach. The Kutunaha have been dispersed by the same economic forces affecting rural Native tribes everywhere. And I mean rural, as Yakanuki principal Karen Smith explains.
With the housing situation and the employment situation, a lot of families have moved off reserve. That really left us with not very many kids. When I started here 3 years ago, there were 19 kids.
And then something unexpected happened.
We have somehow caught on in the community, and we are a school of choice.
In just 3 years, enrollment has nearly quadrupled. There are now 74 kids at the Yakanuki School. The thing is, only 12 of them are Kutunaha. But all the kids are studying the Indigenous language and culture. Here are three of those students, Olivia, Dana, and Devenda, reciting the Kchinakha school pledge. I asked the three kids about their backgrounds.
And are you Kchinakha?
No.
No.
Both my grandparents are Kchinakha on both sides.
So only one out of these three, though you wouldn't know it from hearing them speak the language. Yakanuki may be rich in enthusiasm, but the budget for its language program is zero. School principal Karen Smith says, in contrast to the generous funding French immersion programs receive, there is no money available for programs like Yakanuki's.
Even after the apology and Truth and Reconciliation report, they just won't even put it on the table for discussion.
She is hoping that changes under the new Trudeau government, which has promised to increase funding. But for now, the school relies on elders like Anne Jimmy to preserve a language they were once forced to forget.
When I hear the language, it touches me. It makes me feel really good to hear the language and to see these kids. And it also brings me back to my childhood when I was 5 years old, when that was the language I spoke. I get emotional, I get tears in my eyes when I hear the little ones singing a song in our language.
I was asked not to record any of the songs the kids were practicing the day I visited, ceremonial songs for an upcoming powwow. But a week later, Jenny forwarded me some modern covers from a CD called Kchinakha Pop that she and her grandmother both liked. Kchinakha meets the 21st century. For the World, this is Alina Simone from Creston, British Columbia.
There is a lot more to that story, and you can hear it in our podcast, All About Language, The World in Words. You can find it and subscribe to it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.